You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Commander Tom Garcia, and this is the American Hour. Thanks for tuning in. We've got some big news going on today, and we'll get to that. But, of course, my lovely co-host, Paula Lozon Osman, is with me. How are you doing today, Paula?
Doing great, Tom. How are you?
Excellent. How's the weather there in Boston?
It is a cloudy, rainy 59 out. Still waiting for
the... Yeah, it's about... Well, I think that's about what it is here in Sao Paulo. I think I'm done flying here for the year. It's getting too cold for me. And there's no heat in the room in this hotel. Don't like that. So I'm wearing a sweatshirt and sweatpants around, you know, all day. And I'm sure people are going, oh, boo-hoo, Tom. But, yeah, boo-hoo. I like being in Florida where I wear shorts and a tank top. So, anyway, won't be flying back here. I am flying to Madrid next month. So I'll be, but we won't be broadcasting from there because I'm flying there over the weekends, which is good, which means I have all the weekdays to broadcast from home. I'll probably end up changing my schedule around a little bit to accommodate stuff. But in any case, people, go to our Facebook page right now. If you're listening, go to the Facebook page. Go get into Facebook and go to the American Hour Radio Show. I've got a link right there to the pre-1967 map of Israel. In other words, before they took land in their struggle with Egypt and Jordan, and you will be amazed. So go there and take a look at that. We'll talk about that as we get in the show. There's some other news we want to talk about, but this is the big news today. President Obama siding with the Palestinians. I think it's just an absolute disgrace, and I'll tell you exactly why. He's either a complete idiot or he hates Israel. One of the two. There's no in-between, and I'll explain why that is here in a little bit. But he has done them no favors whatsoever. He really has harmed them significantly with this. All right, let's go back to some of the other news that had occurred earlier, either yesterday or tomorrow, or in the morning. And remember, Paula, we said that we're going to kind of focus a little bit here for the rest of the month on what we're doing to help other countries, but not helping our own people. So yesterday we talked a little bit about illegal immigration in that regard. But let's talk about some of the president's proposals on helping out the Middle East. Let's see. After the meeting, Mr. Obama and the U.S. will provide, and this is, let's see, Obama met Tuesday with King Abdullah of Jordan. He said, after the meeting, the U.S. will provide Jordan with hundreds of millions of dollars through the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, the government institution that finances and insures private business to promote economic growth. The result, according to the U.S., will be roughly $1 billion in economic activity in Jordan. $1 billion, wow. The president also pledged 50,000 metric tons of wheat. All this will help stabilize the cost of living and day-to-day situation of Jordanians. Wow, we're so concerned about the Jordanians. Our president is just so concerned about the Jordanians. Well, Paula, let's see what he thinks about our veterans. Found this job. Now, this page, going back about a couple months, veterans struggling to find jobs. Employers worry about redeployment, mental health issues. More than one in five young Iraq and Afghanistan veterans were employed last year, the Labor Department said. Concerns that Guard and Reserve troops will be gone for long stretches and the veterans might have mental health issues or lack civilian work skills appear to be factors keeping the unemployment rate for, Iraq and Afghanistan veterans at 20.9%. So essentially 21%. Okay, so the national unemployment is 9%, right? Veterans who have put their lives on the line, 21%. Mm. Now, what is it for that same age group? Of course, now, the unemployment numbers are always deceiving. In the age group from 18 to 24, the unemployment rate is 17.3%. But veterans, it's worse. You would think we would want to hire somebody with that kind of experience, that kind of real-world experience, somebody that probably really cherishes having a job back here in the U.S., et cetera. But no, the employers out there, they're military-friendly and veteran-friendly, and they love us and thank us and everything. But when you apply for a job, it's almost like they're scared to take a risk on you. I don't get it. It doesn't make sense, says Iraq veteran Christopher Kurse. He's 28. He just moved back in with his parents in Arizona after spending 2 years looking for a law enforcement work in New York. This guy was a military police officer in Iraq and aboard a nuclear carrier, but that didn't help him get a job. Let's see what else we have to say about this stuff. One of the largest government efforts post 9/11, the GI Bill, administered by the Veterans Affairs Department, which by the end of last year had paid out nearly $7 billion in tuition, housing, stipends, and more for 425,000 veterans or their eligible family members. This guy said that without the GI Bill, he probably would have been homeless or moving back with his parents. So the GI Bill was going to help him go to school, and that's what he ended up doing. He couldn't get a job, so he'd go back to school. I mean, that's good. We're helping them. But why are we giving billions to help, as the Obama administration says, or no, Mr. Obama himself said, to help stabilize the cost of living and day-to-day situation of Jordanians? He's concerned about all Jordanians. When it comes to veterans, only some, because not all are getting the help they need. Yes, there are programs in place, but they're not going to be able to help all of the veterans. He is blanket helping all of the Jordanians. Blanket helping veterans? No. They're on their own. Sorry about that. Let's see. Here we got a Staff Sergeant Megan Mead, 27, in New York, said her lack of a bachelor's degree also seems to have kept her from getting a full-time job, even administrative work. She's a member of the Air National Guard in New York and said she spent 5 years on active duty and did a tour in Iraq. When she brings up her military experience, she said she gets a lot of questions about when she will deploy again. She has an associate's degree, but she's reluctant to go back to school because she's not sure what to study. She's waiting tables and doing temporary clerk work. Now, this, I think, is a disgrace, the way we treat our veterans, and especially our returning soldiers.
Of course it is.
The opportunities are there, but again, as we talked about, Paula, what are we doing to help other countries in a big way? And then, you know, well, first of all, what did we say? What I just read, that the $7 billion in the GI Bill. We've paid out, which by the end of last year has paid out nearly $7 billion. Okay, $7 billion since 9/11. $7 billion since 9/11. So it's taken us 11 years, or I'm sorry, 10 years, 10 years to pay out $7 billion. So that's less than $1 billion a year. But according to President Obama, we're going to be shelling out $1 billion, like, right away to Jordan, because it's critical over there. But our veterans here know. What do you think about all this?
I guess the word would be dumbflux. I had seen something last night come across the New York Times that said, you know, U.S. unveils $2 billion aid package for Egypt. Few game-changing proposals are emerging to diffuse soaring tensions in the Middle East as a busy week of diplomacy unfolds with President Obama's address to the region and his meeting with Israel's prime minister. Against the backdrop of Middle East uprisings that have intensified toward Israel and growing momentum for global recognition of a Palestinian state, American and Israeli officials are struggling to balance national security interests against the need to adapt to a transformative movement in the Arab world. The White House unveiled a $2 billion multi-year economic aid package for Egypt, which officials say would largely shift existing funds. That's all fine and well, and I understand that, you know, there is money that's appropriated from different funds for different things that are going on. But what about us?
Yeah.
What about our veterans?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not liking it at all. I mean, I came across an article here. 4 years after scandal, senators say care of wounded vets still lags. Exposed shortcomings in the treatment of America's wounded soldiers. Top officials with the Defense Department and the DVA have sought to assure Congress on Wednesday that vast improvements have been made, but it was a tough sell. Democrat Patty Murray of Washington State, who is the chairwoman of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, said the U.S. must step up its care for wounded soldiers returning from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, including those most at risk of suicide and the 409 who had limbs amputated. after a decade of continuous conflict. She's concerned that the nation is becoming desensitized to the physical and psychological wounds of war. Desensitized to the physical and psychological wounds of war. We send our men and women to go fight. They come back, and we're not sensitive to their needs. But we're going to send money to the other countries because we're sensitive to their needs? I don't know. I think somebody needs to explain this to me, Tom.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. Our veterans are taking a back seat to Middle Eastern countries. And then finally, you know, the president has pledged that from now on our policy is to help transformative countries, countries that are trying to gain a democracy. Well, who is behind some of these things? We still don't absolutely know yet whether any of these countries are going to become any kind of a democracy or any kind of an ally that would be better than what was there before. You know, when the Shah was deposed, and we sort of kind of influenced that back then as well, what did we end up with? A revolution, but we ended up with basically another, we'll call it a theocracy there, but I think it's more of a dictatorship. You got an Ayatollah that tells everybody what to do. I realize there's a group of Ayatollahs, but the head Ayatollah, that guy's pretty much in charge, and what he says goes. And Iran is one of the most dangerous countries over there. So we got rid of one dictator, and look what we end up with. That's a perfect example of what could happen in any one of these countries. But our policy now is to help the rebels. Rebels anywhere. Now, what does he mean by that? I guarantee you this is what it means. It's going to be financial aid. It's going to be financial aid. So here we go back to the money, but not our vets. No, we can't give any more money to our vets. In fact, we're actually thinking about cutting benefits and giving them higher deductibles and everything with their health benefits. But yeah, so when we make them pay higher deductibles for their health benefits, we can take that extra money that the government gets now and give it to Egypt and the Palestinians. But so not only are we going to be giving money, but I guess this president, the Nobel Peace Prize winning president, if necessary, we'll go drop a few bombs here and there, wherever it's kind of needed, because that's our policy now. We've pledged to support revolutions and civil wars on the side of the unknown freedom fighters, fighting for freedom to what? Practice Sharia law, fighting for freedom to whatever. We'll talk more about this, but yeah, this is a disgrace that we treat our veterans like this, and we have other groups in our country of folks that, whether they be homeless, just simply poor, etc., that we're not working to, as the president said, stabilize the cost of living in day-to-day situation. Oh, in fact, stabilize the cost of living. Let me read you something from an article here by David Pear, I believe, or David Paul. Oil price swings as a dollar hedge pose a new threat to our fiscal future. Now, this was posted today. Essentially, what he's saying on here is oil prices are a hedge against the dollar. In other words, if oil prices drop, dollar strengthens. If the dollar starts getting weak, oil prices go up. And that's what people are doing to hedge against the falling dollar. If the dollar starts falling, they start buying oil. And so he finishes off the article by saying this. I'm just going to read what he said in the end. It may be that the end of the qualitative easing that the Fed just did, the dollar will stabilize, and with the rhetorical drumbeat for new energy policies will subside. But the lesson should be internalized into our national debate over debt and deficits, as the same oil price shock that emerged from deliberate Fed policy to depress the value of the dollar will be visited upon us with greater ferocity should global bond markets give up on our ability to put our fiscal house in order and to leave us with a decline in the value of the currency and accelerated energy costs that is out of our control. So we have a monetary policy here in the U.S. that has driven prices up, the value of the dollar down, but the president, he wants to stabilize the cost of living and day-to-day situation for Jordanians. My goodness, he's just such a good guy when it comes to other countries. When it comes to his own country, he doesn't seem to care much about us, or he's incompetent enough to do anything and work with the Congress and the Senate on stabilizing our money, stabilizing our oil prices, cutting our debt. He doesn't seem to want to do that, but he wants to help everybody else out. So anyway, that was sort of my focus this morning on looking at what are we doing abroad versus what are we doing here, and it's pretty pretty clear that we're doing more abroad to help people and stabilize their lives and cost of living. But then another article that caught my eye this morning was on The Hill. And let's see, it's Bob German wrote this, and this was from yesterday. Senate rejects GOP bill to expand speed up offshore drilling. You know that the Congress passed a bill saying we're going to, you know, basically undo the president's any moratorium he or the Department of Interior put on drilling, et cetera. And this is how we're going to do it. So, unfortunately, every Senate Democrat voted against the motion, along with five Republicans. And I'm going to name the Republicans. A lot of people like Jim DeMint. I see Jim DeMint for president. Huh. Explain this one to me. Okay, Senators Jim DeMint, Mike Lee of Utah, Richard Shelby, of course, one of the usuals to vote against conservatism, Olympia Snow, and David Vitter from Louisiana. I guess we don't want to speed oil drilling. And you know, their argument was, well, the bill rushes things too much, and it doesn't give the Department of Interior the opportunity to, you know, ensure security and safety in drilling. Look, and here's what they said. The bill would compromise beefed-up safety standards imposed after the BP oil spill. And let's see, they also said it doesn't give the Department of Interior, I know I said that, I was just going to read it here, but anyway, it doesn't, oh, here we go. The White House slammed the permitting deadline in the GOP bill, arguing it would constrain Interior's, the Department of Interior's, ability to ensure permits meet safety standards. Well, I mean, the Department of Interior does such a good job. As long as it's given time, it ensures that permits meet safety standards and does a fantastic job. Oh, except in the BP oil spill. Yeah, that's right. If anybody had inspected that oil rig after it was put in place, they would have found that the oil rig itself did not match the design, the design blueprints. So they didn't build it the way they proposed they would build it to the Department of Interior. And then after, again, nobody looked at that. But as time went on, it had over 700 safety violations. And what did the Department of Interior do? Oh, keep operating. You haven't been built properly, and you have violation after violation, but you keep on operating. So my confidence in the Department of Interior is pretty much zero. The Department of Interior gets an F- on its safety. Yet the White House is saying, boy, we got to be careful here, and we can't hastily open up Gulf areas and Alaska and the Atlantic without adequate environmental analysis because the Department of Interior does such a good job. What an outright lie. The Department of Interior has absolutely failed us. Get rid of it. We're better off without them. I know of a handful of people that could do what that entire $15 billion a year department is doing when it comes to oil, and we could do it in a matter of months, but they're incapable because they're a government bureaucracy that is bloated and has lost its way. One of the ways to get bureaucracies like that to find their way is to cut them significantly. I'd say cut them from $15 billion to about $400 million. They'd get their act together really fast. Or not. Maybe they'd just sit around. If we find they're just sitting around reading their newspapers at their desk, then we just completely eliminate them. In any case, and I know somebody will call in here and say, Tom, the Department of Interior covers a lot of different things besides just oil drilling. Yeah, I know. And how are they doing on those things? Not good. So anyway, sorry if your dad or you work in the Department of Interior. I'm going to really apologize. I worked in the military for 22 years, and I know there was all kinds of waste in the military that needed to be rooted out, and I did that toward the end of my career. And it was safety-oriented as well, and I got a medal for that work. I'm not trying to brag about it. I'm just trying to let you know. I know a little something about how safety works and how inspections work. But I got a medal when I retired that said I had not only saved lives but saved money. And according to Safety Center statistics, during that four-year period, we, with the programs we initiated and revamped, and I was a big part of that, saved the Navy and Marine Corps $1.2 billion. So that was eight people. Eight people saved the military that kind of money, and I could have gone a lot farther. And that was working part-time as a reservist. So I know a little something about this. So don't whine to me that the Department of Interior is doing a great job. I guarantee you I could go spend 1 week within the Department of Interior and find a horrific amount of waste. Guarantee it, because that's what I do. All right. So what do you think of that, Paula?
Well, the GOP oil drilling bill failed to pass the Senate today. I guess a Louisiana senator was one of five Republicans to vote against legislation introduced by Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell to expand offshore oil drilling. And the Republican senator from Louisiana, David Vitter, said that he opposed the measure, similar to bills passed by the Republican House, because it didn't go as far as the House bills in opening new tracts along the Atlantic and Pacific coasts in the Eastern Gulf for drilling. The measure included a provision that would have gone further than the current Interior Department regulations and require a third-party review of containment response provisions of any exploration plans. I had come across something else as well that, you know, we have enough capacity to drill for oil so long as it's in shallow water.
Uh-huh.
And it would have to start now. It's something that had come out today as well. No drilling leases have been available off the Atlantic coast since the early 1980s, and one of the industry's issues with the current policy is the postponement of a lease sale planned for 2011 until 2017, although the president has indicated that they might become available sooner. What would drilling in the Atlantic really do to impact the price of oil? According to the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, the answer is not much. In a study on the Outer Continental Shelf, 3.8 billion barrels of oil are estimated to be technically recoverable in the Atlantic region out of the 85.9 billion barrels for the U.S. as a whole. And then there's a chart as to how they break it down, but based on the data, the individual suggests that pursuing drilling in the Atlantic is all but worthless, while focusing on the Gulf of Mexico and Alaska is the prudent choice.
Yeah. Well, wherever it is, that's where we should be going. Wherever we can get it the fastest and the easiest and safest, we ought to be looking at that. But, you know, we'll just sit about here and argue about this and never get anywhere. And everybody's got their little opinion about, you know, where we should or shouldn't be drilling. The bottom line is this. You know, let me see if I – actually, this one might have had some comments on it. Let me see if anybody comment on this one. No, there were some interesting comments on another similar page that I went to about oil, et cetera, and people were saying, you know, oh, no, we don't want to drill here. We want to save all our oil here so we can, you know, go and support Brazil with their oil and buy it from them and become a partner with them. You know, when the president says partner, when you go to, let's just pick a store. Let's say you go to Target and you buy something. Are you a partner with Target? You're a customer. You're a customer.
Right.
I don't understand this whole partner thing. We want to partner with Brazil so we can loan them money. That's called being a banker. And then buy their oil. That's called being a customer. I don't see partnering anywhere. Are we going to reap some of the profits of that? No. Yeah. Anyway, it's a nice way to use different words to cover up what you're really doing. But
the reality is... The understanding is that we only have enough capacity to drill for the oil, but only if it's in shallow water. So even if we could get the oil out of the ground quickly, we would make only a small dent on world supplies. And at best, expanding drilling will likely only increase world supply about around 1%, which is something that OPEC could offset with one meeting. The individual that wrote this article suggested that drilling shouldn't be opened up off the U.S. market. Doing so would definitely help increase domestic production, but we should keep the impact of that drilling in perspective. Opening drilling isn't likely to have much of an effect on oil or gasoline prices anytime soon. So we discuss and debate drilling all we want, just like you said, but I think our attention would be better focused on natural gas and renewable energy where we can make a real difference.
Okay, I hate to say it, the guy's completely wrong. Renewable energy, we can't make a difference as fast with oil. He's absolutely wrong. What he's doing is saying we can't make a dent in the world supply. We don't need to make a dent in the world supply. We need to make a dent in the U.S. supply. Who cares about the rest of the world? Yes, I realize we get our oil from all over the world, but the shipping costs alone of bringing oil all the way from the Middle East here is pretty substantial. And in fact, the oil companies make a lot of money off of shipping oil. If we're getting it right here at home, we're not having to pay the extra price for the shipping. So he's completely wrong on that idea. And I'd like to know which renewable he thinks we can outpace drilling, even in shallow waters. This is the age-old story of, yeah, we can't make a difference right now in the immediate future, so let's just not do anything or minimal. Wrong. We said that 10 years ago and 10 years before and 10 years before. And I'm really tired of hearing these guys say this stuff. It's disingenuous, I think.
Well, you know, it's his opinion.
Yeah, it's his opinion. It's the same old opinion I've been hearing since I was a kid, and we had the oil crisis in the 70s. So, but we don't need to make a dent in the world oil supply. I mean, when does anybody ever say, you know, we need to, you know, if we're looking at some overcapacity, whether it be clothing or cars or anything else, we can't make a dent in the world capacity of T-shirts. We don't need to make a dent. I just need to make a dent if I'm a local retailer or, you know, the area I live in, or if I'm a supplier to Walmart, then I need to make a dent in Walmart supply. I don't need to make a dent in the world. So the guy is wrong about that. Oh, it's a global economy, Tom. Yeah, doesn't matter. We need to make a dent in our supply. And so I have a solution for people. Go to the website, usaradionetwork.com. Right there, you will see a link to the Keystone pipeline. Keystone Pipeline is a pipeline we will build. Yes, we have to put money into doing that, just like we'd put money into drilling and creating infrastructure for the drilling itself, whether it be offshore, onshore, et cetera. But the pipeline will bring oil from Canada, oil that's there. And that oil is there not necessarily – by the time the pipeline's built, the capacity will be there. The capacity will be there. Unlike – what this guy is suggesting, wow, we can only drill for so much in the next 5 years and it's just shallow and it won't make a dent in the world supply. Once again, we don't need to make a dent in the world supply. We need to make a dent in the U.S. supply. We can reduce our Middle East and Venezuela oil demands by 40% in a short period of time. And so that's something that's very, very important. So what I'm asking people to do is go to the website, click on the link. It'll take you to a page that explains that. And I believe today was the last day for the webinar to go listen to a webinar about how to petition the government on this and, you know, join the public debate. But what you can do at this point is you can sign a petition. And if you go to the Florida Energy Forum, you can Google the Florida Energy Forum online, but here's the web address. It's FLA, that stands for Florida, Energy Forum. So all one word, FLAEnergyForum.com. And under the heading of Do Something on that web page, click on Do Something, and when it says sign a petition, you'll come on down and say, I, the undersigned, as a citizen of the United States of America with residence in Florida, petition this. Now, you know, you don't actually have to live in Florida. We want everybody across the country to do this. And I don't know if it says anything about here, like, well, what if you don't live in Florida? Honestly, I don't know. Just sign it anyway. This states, and I'm not saying to be deceptive, it's just you as an American have a right to let the government know. Okay, so let's see what else it says. It says increased taxes on the energy sector would threaten existing and new American jobs. I join the overwhelming majority of Americans who support expanded domestic production as well as the oil and natural gas industry's role in improving America's American economy, job creation, and strengthening our national energy security. Now, these guys are for all kinds of different types of energy as well as gas, and I believe, yes, we need to work harder at utilizing gas. But I can tell you this, Paula, in Florida where I live, none of the communities that I live in my area have gas piping. And so if I wanted gas, I couldn't use it. It's not available. So even if I wanted to expand whether the heating of my house and anything else and put in a stove with a gas stove, couldn't do it because it's not available. But there are plenty of places across the country that have that available. They may have a gas stove, but they're not using gas heating, so it would be available. You fill out this little petition, and you send it in, and it helps out. The other thing is you could contact them. You just go to their contact page and say, hey, what can I do? And they'll give you some information. They'll give you a media pack and some other things. So the Keystone Pipeline bringing oil from Canada right on down all the way through the central portion of the U.S. down to Texas, and refineries along the way. It's a great idea. I think we ought to do it. If you don't agree with me, don't do it, but go take a look at it. So that's right there on the website. And so there we have it. We're going to continue to argue, Paula, about oil production and all this other stuff. And and get there. we'll just keep muddling along, it looks like, and then hope that somebody can figure out a way to put a windmill in my backyard once I have no longer have any electricity, and then hope the wind blows. Solar panels. That's what I need to do in Florida. I really need to do solar panels. They're just so expensive. I can't buy them right now. And people tell you, oh, but Tom, they'll pay you back over time. Yeah, pay me back over time. Great. But I got to pay up front. And yes, it's an investment. That's what people do. Well, if the government were serious about this, they'd come up with a plan so that people wouldn't have to pay up front and that people would pay back over time. But we're not going to get into that whole thing today. All right. So let's go on to the bigger news today about the president siding with Palestine, the Palestinians. Now, I want to tell people that we've got some good guests coming on here in the next couple days, and I probably should have said this up at the beginning of the show, but tomorrow, John Statham, go to either our Facebook page. In fact, that's where you should go. Go to the Facebook page. Go to the American Hour Radio Show. Now, if you're not on Facebook, okay, go to the website, usaradionetwork.com. Go to my page, and you'll see the information there. I don't know I think I put a link to the press release on him. If not, it's definitely on the Facebook page. But here's the deal. He is a country Western singer and lives in Nashville. He got contacted by some folks that wanted to do this song, and one of them, the song was written by a guy out in California, and it's a Tea Party song. It's become a Tea Party anthem for a lot of different organizations across the country, and we're going to play the song in full tomorrow. But John Statham, country western singer, recording artist, is going to be on the show talking about the Tea Party because he's gotten to attend a bunch of Tea Parties. And I don't know if he was involved in them prior to doing the song, but he is involved now. So he can tell us firsthand the people he sees and the kind of things going on and what kind of reaction he's gotten to the song. But the name of the song is We Are Drinking Tea, and it's as opposed to drinking Kool-Aid anymore. We're not going to drink any more Kool-Aid. But then on Monday, we have got Karen Harrington. She's running for Congress in Florida's District 20. That district has an incumbent by the name of Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I refer to her the meanest lady on the planet. And she never smiles. I've never seen her smile in an interview. She's abrasive, very abrasive. And to the Democrat Party picked to be their DNC chairman. Now, she's not going to step down from her job. She is going to continue to be a congresswoman for District 20 and run the Democrat National Party. I don't know how you do both of those things, Paula. If you want to do either one of those right, you're dedicated full time to that. So she's splitting herself between those two things, which I think is absurd. Good for them, though. If there's a party that should happen to, it's them. But I would never put up with that in the Republican Party. I'd be screaming up and down, no, this is bad. But see, the Democrats, they like it because, one, of who she is. But here's an interesting aspect. She is Jewish, and look what the president did today. He sided with the Palestinians. He said, I am insisting that the state of Israel, give back land and go back to borders pre-1967. Now, I mentioned earlier, go to the Facebook page, www.usaradionetwork.com. Go to my page, and you will see it's not on there. It's on Facebook. I'm sorry. Facebook, the American Hour Radio Show. I've got the link that shows you, and we're going to get into that map to give you an idea. So if you're not able to look at that map right now, I'm going to give you an idea of what this does, but it essentially gives back about half of the entire nation of Israel to Egypt and Jordan, mostly to Jordan. It's indefensible. As a military guy, especially an aviator, I can tell you this, you can't defend that. Especially with modern aircraft and everything we've got today at our disposal and weaponry, which is different than it was back in the 60s. Yes, we had jets and rockets and bombs and everything back then, but it's changed a lot since the 60s. I guarantee you it's changed in a big way, and that is indefensible. Now, given – I'll get to that in a second, but there is a possibility that Israel would have gone that route, but now – we'll get to that in a second. But take a look at that map. We'll discuss it here in a few minutes. But I was talking about Karen Harrington coming on. She's running against Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And here's the kind of person Debbie is. Let me look at this article here and see what the date is. I want to make sure we give it. This would have been, Jewish donors, this is the title, Jewish donors warn Obama on Israel. Now, this was before the speech today. And actually, the date on this article, it looks like, was today. but this was before, Jewish leaders are saying, listen, you better be careful. We're not happy. Now, Paul, I have to tell you something. I have a friend who ran for Congress in, I believe it was District 15 in Florida, in southern Florida, and there's a large Jewish community there. And he's a great guy, good conservative, but smart, intelligent, common sense. And he'd meet with different groups that weren't necessarily Jewish groups, but had predominantly Jewish people in them, and they'd always like him until they found out he was a Republican. And I've learned this from my Jewish friends as well. I have some very conservative Jewish friends, and I've come up with this theory. It's a hypothetical thing, but if Moses were to return to Earth and decide to get into politics, and he ran as a Republican, Jews would not vote for him because he's a Republican. They just, it doesn't matter who it is. They would actually not vote for Moses. They'd love him, and they'd be praising him, and they'd say they agree with everything that he was proposing, but then when they find out he's a Republican, sorry, Moses, we can't vote for you. That's how adamant they are about voting Democrat. And it goes back, we won't go into the history of that, but the bottom line is it doesn't matter today who they – so they're trying to warn. Can you – if you've been watching the news over the last couple of years, what the president has done by dissing repeatedly Israel, that anybody of the Jewish faith today – would even consider voting for him. And yet this article is, let me do the title again, Jewish donors warn Obama on Israel. They're warning him. I mean, I don't know how many times. It's sort of like a guy comes up to you and stabs you with a knife and you warn him not to do it again, and he does it again and again and again. And you just keep warning him. I mean, that's what, it's gotten to that point. Well, I wonder if they've finally gotten it after his speech. They've finally gotten it. But here's Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who her opponent we're going to have on the radio on Monday, and I think this is very timely. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, chairwoman of the Democrat National Committee, also congresswoman. Boy, she's really good doing two jobs like that. Said the speech on Sunday, this was the president's speech that he gave to an AIPAC speech on Sunday, which is an Israeli Alliance Strong, organization, said the speech on Sunday should help set the record straight. Now, here's the quote from her. There's nothing like hearing it straight from the President of the United States, his expression that he is strongly pro-Israel. Wow, pro-Israel. And then he said, give back half of your country. That's how we're going to negotiate peace with the Palestinians. Give back half of your country. Now, I remember Yasser Arafat saying that's what was needed. Wow, he's on the same page as Yasser Arafat. That's great. Why don't we, Paula, go back to 1848 and give back the Louisiana territories and the Floridas and other parts of the United States that was owned by either Spain or the French? I mean, wouldn't that be reasonable? Because, you know, we want to be closer and friendlier with them. Well, the reality is we're not fighting with them like the Palestinians, so why should we give anything back? But what if we were arguing with them and fighting with them? Well, let's just start giving stuff back. That's going to be our starting point. Now, here's the point I was going to make about – so anyway, let me back up. So Representative Wasserman Schultz was completely wrong. She said he is strongly pro-Israel. Now, first of all, just saying you heard it straight from his mouth, straight from the President of the United States. Well, we've learned that he lies repeatedly on many, many issues, so hearing it straight from him is meaningless. He'll say one thing and do something else. And I'll get into another article that shows you exactly that his speech is 180 degrees from the campaigner. And the candidate, Barack Obama. So he's a massive flip-flopper on Middle Eastern policy. But I guess he's really learned that he needs to be more in line with somebody like George Bush in order to succeed in the Middle East. So that's what he's done. He campaigned against George Bush on everything. I mean, George Bush wasn't even running, but he campaigned against George Bush on everything he was doing in the Middle East. And now he's completely flip-flopped on all that stuff. But Debbie was completely wrong. Completely wrong. After his statement today, he's strongly pro. If you're strongly pro-Israel, here's what you don't do. You don't say, give back half of your country, and then we'll negotiate from there. You know, Israel might have been willing to do that if the negotiations had proceeded and reached a point where they needed an ace up their sleeve. And when I say an ace up their sleeve, not to like knock out the Palestinians or kind of screw them over, but rather an ace up their sleeve to say, okay, we're at a standstill. We got one last thing to work hammer out here. I tell you what, how about we do this? How about we go back to pre-1967 and then we'll do a little land swapping. It won't end up that way, but let's make that our starting point right here. Now that we got everything else sorted out, what do you guys think of that? hey, we kind of like that idea. It might be able to get them past a final sticking point. But no, the president let the cat out of the bag. Now, it might not have been a cat in the bag. It might have been something was considered. But Israel could have been saying all along, we refuse to even consider that. But we will negotiate. That we're not going to talk about. But, so it's like playing poker. That's what it is. It's like a poker game. And the president just revealed Israel's hand. So, again, he's either an idiot and doesn't understand the game of politics, or he hates Israel, or he's just incompetent, or here's the better one, it's just about him. He wanted to put together a proposal that put everything on the table, didn't help Israel out in any way. So to say he's strongly pro-Israel, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, you're absolutely wrong. You're absolutely wrong like you normally are. So this was very damaging to Israel. It tipped a hand that they may have been able to use on down the road in the negotiations. You don't start off the negotiations with your first ace or your biggest ace. You don't do that. You save it. So I don't know where it's going to go from here, but this was not good. Let's take a look at the pre-1967 borders. And if you don't have it in front of you, folks, and you can't get to it, I'll just tell you that the size of Israel, is very, very small. It's not large. And I don't have on this map a scale that would show you everything, but I'm going to estimate, just eyeballing it, it's at maybe the midpoint, and it gets larger toward the south, narrower to the top. So at this widest point down to the south, it may be around 50 miles wide. 50 miles. Up toward the north, it looks like it's closer to about 25, 30 miles. Got the Mediterranean Sea bordering on one side. That'd be out to the west. Out to the east, you've got Jordan. And the map shows in yellow, prior to 1967, what Jordan owned, which was a huge chunk of the center of Israel. And what going back to that border would do, as an example, would put that border of Jordan 11 miles from Tel Aviv. 11 miles. Next major city to the south, Ashdod. It would put the closest point of approach, and I think there's a closer point. Jerusalem actually is tucked into this sort of like crotch area that Jordan owns. So Israel extends over, but you'd be surrounded by Jordan on either side. So it's kind of like walking into a canyon, and you've got the walls on either side. And so Jerusalem, half of Jerusalem, which is owned by, it's all owned by Israel because it's all in Israel, but half of Jerusalem that is, frequented by the Jewish population there would be literally surrounded by Jordan. But the closest point of approach is about 22 miles to Ashdod. And then down in Ashkelon, where you've got the Gaza Strip, which was under Egyptian rule, is now under Israeli jurisdiction, would put Egypt 7 miles from the southern city there, Ashkelon, 7 miles. And we don't know what's going to happen with Egypt here. We don't know what direction they're going, but we know that the Muslim Brotherhood is having a pretty big effect on them there. Up to the north, Haifa, it would put Jordan 21 miles from Haifa. This is not what you want to do if you're going to try and protect your people and protect your borders. To take away, it would be, I'm just trying to think, imagine Florida, for example, Paula, and taking, the western half, starting about midway up, going up to where the panhandle starts, and midway down to the Key West, midway down, so that chunk, and going over to within, anywhere from 9 to 15, 20 miles of the eastern shore of Florida, and saying this is now going to be some other country and that isn't necessarily friendly with you or could certainly be unfriendly with you in the future. And that's what you got. That's what you got to work with. That's not enough. That's not enough. It's not good.
We have Steve Rosenblum on the line.
Yeah, oh, good, Steve. I thought about calling you today when I heard about this, but Steve, give us your take on all of this, because I know you're very familiar with this information.
Well, I guess I'll start with where I kind of heard you talking about the members of Congress and people running for Congress down here in South Florida trying to get the Jewish vote. And I don't know if you were referring to Ed when you were mentioning District 15.
Yeah,
but,
I was.
Yeah, or District 19. But
oh, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, he – well, no problem. He and Robert Lowry, when he ran against W. Wasserman Schultz in 20, you know, they basically found the same thing, that, you know, you run for Congress and you go into the Jewish communities, the so-called condo commandos, and they're really not that interested in Israel is part of the problem. Just they're kind of selfish about Medicare, and they don't really seem to care that much that, you know, they're taking away from the future of their grandchildren. They don't care that much about Israel. That's a huge problem. But Debbie Wasserman Schultz and Robert Wexler, before he was succeeded by Ted Deutsch, they've always tried to make it seem like they're pro-Israel, and they're really not pro-Israel themselves, which makes it very easy for them to go along with President Obama. Robert Wexler was the campaign chairman for South Florida, or maybe it was all of Florida, for Barack Obama in 2008, and he sold the Jewish voters, the Democrats, on the idea that Obama was pro-Israel. But if you ever did his office, you would see on his wall, Robert Wexler, all the pictures of him with people from the Middle East or with people from Saudi Arabia and Jordan and all the Arab leaders, no leaders from Israel whatsoever. So it's interesting that way. And Ted Deutsch was running.
Yeah.
I asked him multiple times. I said, do you agree with what President Obama and Joe Biden have said, that the Palestinians have to have a contiguous state? I said, because if you take a quick look at the map, a contiguous Palestinian state is going to result in a divided Israel. And he would never answer that question directly. He always said the same thing. He said, I have said over and over that I am for an undivided Jerusalem, but he would never answer the question of a divided Israel. And Obama said it again today, a contiguous Palestinian state. So unless he's talking about a huge land swap where maybe the Israelis took over Gaza, and I don't know why you'd want Gaza at this point, and gave up some land around the West Bank to compensate for that, I don't see how you have a contiguous Palestinian state without a divided Israel.
Yeah, exactly. That's the part. I mean, you've got to look at this strategically. We used to fly in an area out over Arizona that allowed us to simulate, you know, being in sort of tight quarters. And the area we flew in was bigger than the Bekaa Valley that I guess it was the Six-Day War or Seven-Day War. I don't even remember what it was now. Back in the 60s was fought with Israel and, I believe, Egypt. And that it's very, very tight, very, very tight quarters, doing that kind of flying in such tight quarters and fighting, and even with ground support, et cetera. Their country is so small. Netanyahu is right when he said it's indefensible to go back to that. Indefensible in today's modern warfare. It's absolutely indefensible. And they can't. They really can't do it. It just opens the door to, you know, here's what I saw one blogger say today. It said, all right, go ahead and do that. Go back to 1967, and the first mortar round that falls into Israel territory, the very, very one that falls, we're back to 1967, and we'll just kick all of the Palestinians out of Israel. I love how they talk about the Palestinian territory. That's like saying that Arizona is a Mexican territories, or the, you know, because we've got so many illegal immigrants there. Well, it kind of feels like it sometimes, but you know what? We're the United States of America. And Israel is a sovereign state, and it owns that land. And as a military guy, I've always felt this way. Right or wrong, when you go to war with somebody and you take land, it's yours now. Nobody can come along and say, but, you know, you really shouldn't take that. Hey, they fought us. They didn't. They attacked us. We didn't have to go to war with them, but they attacked us. So guess what? Now we own that land. It's just the way it goes. And we're never giving it back. And that's the way it goes. It's been that way since the beginning of time. We can go around the world and start looking at all the different countries that have land that they didn't have 100 years ago. And say, well, everybody's got to give that land back to whoever else. That's called disputes with your neighbors, et cetera, and you work those out, and you try diplomacy, but when it finally doesn't work and somebody attacks you, that's the price you pay. You know, if Egypt attacks Israel, Jordan attacks Israel, and they take land, hey, we're keeping it. That's just the way it's going to be. So I have no sympathy for any of them, and you know that the instant any kind of deal like this is put forward, the mortars will still keep raining down on Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities. It won't stop any of that. So I'm absolutely opposed to reducing the borders in any way whatsoever, because we know what the Palestinians are capable of, and that is nothing but hatred for Israel.
You're right. I mean, with the exception of the Camp David Accords, where Israel gave back the Sinai to Egypt, Every other time Israel has given any land back in exchange for peace, they've been double-crossed. Every time they give up the land, inevitably that land is taken over by the terrorists and rockets start flying or mortars start flying from that land. And you, one of the things you left out of your analysis, which I'm sure was inadvertent, was that 1967 borders would also give the Golan Heights back to Syria, which would be a huge strategic mistake for Israel, and I'm sure that Netanyahu would never do that, especially now with Syria having so much upheaval. You could just see Assad doing what Arabs do all the time, turning and trying to make Israel the bad guy, maybe even trying to make it look like the uprising was instigated by Israel, and all of a sudden he would use having the Golan Heights as a way to attack Israel all over again. Because that's a huge strategic piece of land, because they can look down on the valley and just shoot mortars and tank rounds and put anti-aircraft guns there, and it makes it almost impossible for the Israelis to attack that piece of land. The last time they did it, they lost 115 soldiers.
Yeah, and you know, I'm surprised. I don't know why. You're right. I did miss that. Golan Heights aren't showing up on this map. Well, that's not a complete map of Israel. That may be part of it because it's not showing up to the north, and that may be why we're not seeing the former Syrian Golan Heights. But that's they cannot give any of that back. They just cannot. It's too dangerous. And a country like Syria, I mean, there's no chance of peace with them. They're going to do everything they can to undermine Israel. So to put this out there, and here's the way I really look at it myself is. It's possible that something like this might have been negotiated if a lot of other things had been negotiated in good faith first between the Palestinians and the Israelis. At the very end, if the negotiators felt, you know what, things are going really well, this could be the icing on the cake, and we feel like we've really made such tremendous ground, but we've got like one or two last things that just are real stumbling blocks. They could have thrown this out here as a major bargaining chip, but the president just erase that for them. It's gone now. No bargaining chip anymore. I mean, it could be, but they're going to have to say no, 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 and make everybody forget about that the president never brought it up. But for the president to bring that up is just absolutely incompetent statesmanship. I mean, just absolutely incompetent for him to even bring that up. So this guy is really harming our Middle Eastern policy. And, you know, some of the other things that he's talked about in the Middle Eastern policy, you know, billion here, billion there, we're going to invest in this, invest in that. And the fact that, you know, the U.S. is now going to assist any country over there that decides they want to revolt. I mean, what kind of policy is that? It may be not even do that, but to say it?
It's not even true. I mean, his speech was so spotty and inconsistent and so lacking in reality on the ground. He ignored facts. I mean, he basically said, we stand with anybody that rises up to overthrow a dictator unless you happen to live in Syria or Iran or Yemen or the Ivory Coast. The whole thing is a joke. He ignored the fact that he ignored the Green Revolution in Iran. He let those kids rise up and get slaughtered, and he never said a word. He was out getting ice cream with his kids.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's, you know, that's what, and here's, you know, what one of the analysts had to say. This is, I got this off the BBC, which, you know, is a little bit hard to take sometimes, but one analyst did say that Mr. Obama's speech is an attempt to convince his U.S. audience that the fate of countries in the Middle East and North Africa are worth the money and effort. Now, what do we start our show off with talking about? We're spending money all over the place, except at home where we could use it, is worth the money and effort even during difficult economic times. This guy's an absolute failure at helping our economy and helping businesses and taking the worry and the uncertainty out of the business world, and particularly in the U.S. here. And yet he wants to create that kind of certainty and effort abroad. I mean, the guy is just unbelievable. You know, we unemployment rises to 9% and he's out stumping for immigration reform and then trying to tell us that somehow that's going to help the economy. That's like his health care bill was going to help the economy. And yet now look at all of the waivers that are being given. If it's such a good bill, why did Harry Reid have to get a waiver for his entire state? if it's such a good bill. The guy just lies and lies and lies and will say anything and then can't even focus. He's got ADD or something, I think, Steve, because he can't ever focus on the things that actually matter to Americans. Are Americans are rallying in the streets and protesting the fact that we're not giving billions to the Middle East? No. I don't see any riots going on saying, you better get out there and start helping. I see riots and not riots, but I see protesting in the streets about the economy and jobs and the value of the dollar and oil prices and gas prices. But he can't focus on any of that stuff because he's incompetent to do anything about it.
Well, he has no answers, and all the real answers are contrary to his ideology. So naturally, he has to focus on something else.
Right. That's exactly. It's always a diversion from what the real issue is, because if he told us what his real answer was, it would be gas prices. They're not even close to being high enough. I want to squeeze you people till you beg for mercy and allow give me, you know, cap and trade, which won't make that worse. But you know, this in this speech, this was a 180-degree reversal of the policy, and I'm just reading this from the Daily Caller here. Let's see, Neil Monroe wrote this, but 180-degree reversal in policy towards Iran. Prior to the election, he promised to open up negotiations with Tehran. After his election, he stood silent, as you just said, when the protesting was going on. And now he's talking about, you know, we're going to crack down on Iran, and if we see the government brutalizing men and women, we're going to, you know, get involved somehow. I don't know how. So, you know, once again, he talks in platitudes all the time and never gives us any specifics. What are you going to do in the Middle East? Say, from now on, we're going to help, you know, countries that are falling into civil war, trying to achieve some form of freedom from, as I said earlier in the show, freedom from a dictator, but freedom to now practice a very, brutalizing Sharia law. I mean, what's, you know, what freedom to do what specifically? But we're going to support them with, and you know, he didn't say it again, he leaves the details out, but it'll be like Libya: money, weapons, military effort, and you know, whatever else, and it's all going to be at the expense of the U.S. taxpayer, and we don't even want anything to do with that stuff. So this guy is just kind of a rambling incoherent, doesn't really know what he wants to do about anything, and I never get any substance out of him. Did you get any substance out of that speech, Steve?
Absolutely. The only thing that was substantial was the one thing we talked about, which everybody was even surprised he put in the speech, was the 67 borders. He wasn't even supposed to put that in the speech, according to the White House, but there it was. Now, he is a community organizer-in-chief. He is a man-child. He is petulant. He is thin-skinned. But he has absolutely no idea how to lead a country. He has no idea about foreign policy, military policy, economic policy. My friend Ellen Karras, who's a political satirist, says that she's a CPA. She says that he is economically illiterate, and I think that's exactly right.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, Paula, you know, you've heard me say it many times. This guy's not capable of leading a Cub Scout pack out of a city park. But in any case, now, Steve, tell us who you've got on your show tomorrow and Saturday. I think you've got some good guests coming up here, don't you? Steve, anybody out there doesn't know, Steve Rosenblum, tell us where your show is, where they can find you, and who you've got coming on.
Conservative Republican Forum, or CRF Weekdays during the week. CRF Weekdays is on at 2 p.m. Eastern at blogtalkradio.com/StephenRRepub. And tomorrow at 2, we have our friend, former senior INS agent, Michael Cutler. And we'll be talking about illegal immigration. We'll probably touch on this a little bit as well. And then on Saturday, we're very excited, at 6 p.m. Eastern at the same web address, we have author and media mogul Andrew Breitbart. And we have also in the back half of our show, KT McFarland, the national security expert and Fox News analyst.
Excellent. That's awesome. Now, Michael Cutler is Jewish, correct? Am I like forgetting something here? I'm pretty sure he's.
He is,
yeah.
And he's
so
a registered
Democrat,
I'm sure
he's
going to
have
to hold that against him.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure he's got some very to the point thoughts about what just happened here today with the speech. And so I'm sure, you know, I'm going to want to listen in on your show tomorrow for sure to hear what he has to say about that, because Michael is a very well-spoken guy and very concise, doesn't pull any punches. And, you know, he, when it comes to international security, border security, national security, you name it. He's very well versed in that stuff. So I'm sure he'll have an interesting idea or ideas on this whole thing, especially the 67 borders that maybe you and I haven't thought of or anybody else has. So that should be a very good interview tomorrow. But in any case, well, Steve, thanks for calling in. I appreciate that. It's about time for us to wrap up. I think we've covered most everything, unless you have anything last you'd like to tell us.
No, great show as always, and take care. Look forward to you listening in and even calling in if you like tomorrow. Take care.
Yeah, absolutely. I will definitely call in tomorrow. Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it. You take care. Tell Daria I said hi.
Will do. Bye-bye.
Well, that was a good call, Paula. Steve always has good insight into this kind of stuff, and he does a great show. And anybody listening, definitely go check out his show because he always does a great show and has fantastic guests. And I know Michael will be a good guest tomorrow, particularly talking about this issue. You know, he's fantastic on immigration. We had him on the show ourselves back on Monday, but I know he's going to have some very poignant thoughts about this Middle Eastern speech given by the president today. I know he's going to rip them apart. I know that's what's going to happen because it was incoherent and unrealistic. And I'd just say this, that the one article I was reading here about, let's see, the president basically taking, let me read you the headline. President Obama channels George Bush and talks tough to friends and foes in the Middle East. The whole article, and this is on the Daily Caller, if you go there and look for Neil Monroe, he basically talks about how close to President Bush's, you know, overall Middle Eastern policy, all of a sudden, President Obama is. And, I mean, there are a lot of differences, but he's, you know, even, let's see, here's one of the things he said toward the end. Well, that's not it. I lost it. It was in one of the other articles. But it's an interesting article and how he outlines what and picks apart the president's speech. And, you know, let's see, here's one. The speech was welcomed by supporters of Bush policies. Today's speech at the State Department marks Barack Obama's emergence as a full-fledged, born-again neocon firmly in the George Bush mold, said Max Boot, a supporter of the Iraq campaign and a writer for commentary. There were things about our Middle Eastern policy under George Bush that I was not happy about, but it seems like this president, who wasn't happy about anything, has really, you know, swung around the opposite direction and is trying to repackage George Bush policies as his own in an incoherent manner, let alone. So, I don't know. What are your final thoughts on this, Paula?
I think that president needs to make up his mind and make a determination as to what he wants to do and, you know, the things that he supports. And I think I'm just a little leery about, you know, this whole pre-1967 thing. What could that spark?
Yeah. Yeah, it's well, it just can't work. I mean, like I said, the only way that ever would have got on the negotiating table would be a sort of a pulling a rabbit out of a hat or ace up your sleeve, whatever you want to call it, toward the end to get over a final stumbling block. But you don't start with that. You can't start with that. So it was a huge misstep by this president, huge lack of statesmanship to say something like that. And now Steve was telling us that the White House is saying it wasn't supposed to be in the speech. So now they're seeing what damage he's done, and now they're backpedaling, saying, oh, no, you know what they're probably going to say is, oh, you know what, we're going to save that. You know, we're going to save that toward the end. That shouldn't have been a starting point. Yeah, we'll let Israel, you know, kind of keep that up their sleeve. Well, thanks for bringing it out to begin with. Yes, unbelievable.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think we can. I was trying to find some of these comments from some of these bloggers, but let's see what they had to say. Obama may have overstepped the line today. The Israelis won't be happy, and the U.S. might have to give them more military aid to compensate. I don't know. I'm not saying I agree with any of this stuff. I'm just reading some of the comments that came in on one of these articles. Yeah, that's about it. Worth reading. Let's see. Here's one. Now, this is just kind of humorous. I lived in the U.S. for 72-plus years, so I guess this is an older gentleman or person, and I consider us lucky that only two of the 13 presidents were considered incompetent. The last one, Jimmy Carter, was elected once. I think the current one will join him. Oh, boy.
I guess some of us would hope.
Yeah, I think so. It's just, boy, it just, this guy just never ceases to amaze. And I guess it was in this article where it talked about, you know, here's what they're talking about, the key points. This is, according to the BBC, the key points. If I had to read through the whole thing, I'd probably come up with some other key points. But in the months ahead, the U.S. must use all its resources to encourage reform in North Africa and the Middle East. In the months ahead, all of our resources. What about in the months ahead, all of our resources to fix our own economy and reduce our debt? Boy. We'll cut $1 billion of debt for a democratic Egypt and work to create enterprise funds to invest in Tunisia and Egypt. Oh, we're gonna cut Egypt's debt to us, $1 billion that they owe us, or debt that they owe anybody else. We're gonna help them cut their debt. But we can't cut $1 billion of our own debt. Can you believe that? This is just ridiculous.
Yeah, but we're giving $2 billion to help them out.
Yeah. And we're going to forgive debt in addition to it. So we're really giving them more than $2 billion. We're really giving them more like $3 billion. You know, the Syrian president must lead a political transition or get out of the way. Well, we got – oh, boy. And I did see one blogger that said, you know, we got a president telling another country how they need to manage their borders, and we can't manage our own borders. And that was, you know, our whole immigration show that we did on Monday. Let's see. U.S. will continue to insist the Iranian people deserve their universal rights and a government that does not smother their aspirations. Well, now he's saying it. He didn't say it back then. Let's see. The borders of Israel. And yeah, we already talked about that. So, wow. I mean, it's just like Keystone Cops here in the U.S. all the time with this president and his administration. They're just running around like chickens with their heads cut off. And well, as people get, I have not read the whole speech. It's very difficult for me to read through his whole speech, but I will read through it, and I'll see what I pull out of it. I'll download it, read it tonight, and then maybe we'll talk about it a little tomorrow. But we will have John Statham on. So everybody, why don't we play that song? Let's play the little clip from his song, and here's who we're going to have on the radio tomorrow. John Statham, country music singer and star. And you don't want to miss this. We'll play the whole song tomorrow when he's here and get his take on the Tea Party and what's going on across the country, because I don't know that he's been necessarily like touring or anything like that, but he's gotten to play quite a few venues, Tea Party type venues. And he'll probably have an interesting take on that. But all right, so that's a little taste of it. We'll play the whole thing tomorrow, and I said I was going to pull up some of the lyrics today, but we've run out of time. And anything else? Did you come up with some good late-night jokes? I know you sent me an email, Paula, with that, and I just didn't have a chance to look at it. I didn't know if
late-night jokes. Mitt Romney raised over $10 million in 8 hours. The guy owns a gas station down the street from my house. It's no big deal. That was on Jay Leno.
Okay.
He raised the $10 million, and that's a dollar for every position that he's had on health care.
Oh, boy.
Now, Arnold Schwarzenegger, ouch. Poor Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, I say poor Arnold Schwarzenegger because we've been listening to this nonsense for the last 2 days. The man did a faux pas, big whoop. He ran the state of California. I think he did an okay job. I don't know about anybody else. But he admitted that he had fathered a child with a member of his household staff. And the woman's husband became suspicious when he realized she was the first maid to make $1 million a year.
Oh, you know, I know that for privacy purposes, you know, that nobody's going to show what this woman looks like, but I'd be interested to see what she looks like, just to see, you know, what Arnold's...
They did.
Oh, they did? You've seen what she looks like?
Yes. They did show a picture of her. She was dancing with him at a family party a couple of years back.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
See, I don't understand. You know, I don't know how Maria Shriver would allow. Was she any good looking?
Not necessarily, but that's just my opinion. But the kick in the pants is that both children, both Maria's and the maid's child, were born 5 days apart.
Oh, wow. Oh, man.
I didn't know that.
No, I didn't know any of this. I don't pay attention to the tabloid stuff. I just don't care about that. But it is interesting.
It's not on tabloid.
You know,
It was on Morning Joe this morning. It was on all MSNBC, okay. All over the place. It was nonstop.
Oh,
that's why I said, poor guy, enough already. He committed a faux pas. Done. Get on with the next thing.
I like the way you refer to it, a faux pas. Yeah, pretty big one. But anyway, yeah, it's interesting. I don't know. I have a hard time envisioning this going on. And I guess maybe if you live in a big enough house and all that other stuff, I just find it hard to believe. But whatever. And it doesn't sound like this is the only thing he's done. You know, it's maybe the only woman he's gotten pregnant outside of his marriage, but it sounds like he's been, you know, pretty whatever you want to call it, pretty rambunctious outside the house. So anyway, all right. Any more good jokes?
Such is life. Well, for the last week of her show, Oprah will have 20,000 people in the audience. 3 of them will be men. Now.
Yeah, one of those will probably be Obama.
You never know. Ron Paul announced that he will run for president, and he supports the legalization of prostitution and heroin. If he does win, it will be one heck of a victory party.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah, Ron Paul, boy, I see people that just really are in love with him, and he's got some wacky sides to him that I just don't know.
Oh, you know,
about,
he's entitled.
Yeah. But I don't think I'd want him as serving as president. So, whatever. Now, I saw that Kucinich said he was going to run like in some other state. So, like, he's been representing some state for so many years, and now he said, yeah, I think I'm about running in another state somewhere. He doesn't even know where yet. Now, there's a nutty guy. Boy.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Paula. Well, it's been fun. It's been swell. Thanks for being here today. And I'll be back in Florida tomorrow. So we'll be broadcasting from Florida tomorrow with John Statham, country music star. And we'll talk to him about his music and tea parties and anything else that comes up. And who knows what wacky news will be hitting the headlines tomorrow. But I guess as long as the president doesn't give a speech, there might not be much in the news. Yeah. All right, Paula. Well, thanks. Take care.
Thanks.
Have a great night.
Thanks.
Listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.